Happy Wednesday, April 11th. How are you all? On a scale from 1 to 10, how many of you are at 2 or below? 10 is good. 8 and above? 11. 8 and above, okay. 5. It's the weather, right? 53 degrees in your car. Right, okay. You've heard the forecast for tomorrow. Snow, sleet, you know, all that kind of stuff. 6 inches. More in the mountains. 7 feet of snow still at the top of Mount Mansfield. Skiers and boarders are going to be going into June. Love it. Okay. Questions? Drafts of exercise 5 acceptable through Friday, whatever? Did Talia say Saturday? Yeah. Saturday morning. Okay. Any other questions? Leah. Lila, I'm sorry. Where did Leah come from? I don't know. Lila.
I
do. Me?
Yeah.
8.3. Why not? April, you're all enrolling for next semester, so I get to check in with all my advisees, and they're all doing wonderfully well, and they have summer plans, and now we're planning fall, and okay, so my wife is mobile again, walking on her cast. Oh, I was going to bring the picture. She broke her leg. Thank you for asking, Lila. Okay. Other questions? Then we'll go back to Galinsky and parenting and our Bronfenbrennerian interpretation of what Galinsky is describing as stages that parents go through. And again, the stages are driven by the development of the child. And parents are trying to keep up in the transaction as the transaction is regularly changed by the development of the child. So, a few comments about the image-making stage. We talked about it briefly, but I just wanted to remind you of what some of her concepts are as she's thinking about the image-making stage and what images are. So they're based on history. They're based on our own experience and our understanding of the culture that we are in. So we're creating those images of parenthood from the time we're born. And they're made up of a conglomeration of our experiences, including what our parents have done to us, what we've seen other parents do, what people have talked about, the images in the media. All of those help form those schemas or images in our heads about what parenthood is about. And then our task as we've been growing up is to figure out how we fit, how we are going to be parents within those images. And it may be a determination to be the perfect parent. It may be determination to be the military, hard-ass, authoritarian parent who really keeps those kids from getting into trouble. It may be an image that is based on what we had in our own experience with our parents, and we don't want to be that kind of parent, so our determination is to be different. It's influenced, as we were talking about on Monday, by the current circumstances. So the relationship that you're in is going to have to be part of the new image of yourself as parent. You may have had an image as you were growing up of what it would be like to be a mom or be a dad with the perfect woman or the perfect man, but what you've got is probably not perfect. And you have the reality of the person that you're with, the nature of your relationship, your job, your career, the other responsibilities that each of you have. You're going to have to revise that image according to the current circumstances and the culture that you're in and how it's changed. On page 18, she reviews the work by Lois and Marty Hoffman, who went out and asked people why they were having children, why they wanted to have children, why they did have them. And there's a list there. Think about that list as representing the images that people have of what parenting is going to do for them, why they want to have it, how it fits in with their history, and how they think it's going to change the couple. There are a number of, I think a dozen or so, 15 reasons that they found that are fairly common for parents. Not all of us have all of those reasons, but she reports the ones that they found to be the most common. And they're about images. They're about what the children are going to be like, what we're going to get out of parenting as a molar activity, and what doing that is going to do for us. We have the task of reconciling conflicting images. Our culture is full of conflicting images about parenthood. And many of us have had conflicting experiences. We have had good parents and bad parents. We've had parents at some points in our lives who were very stressed and had a difficult time parenting us, and then things smoothed out for them, and we've had a very different experience with the same people as parents, because parents change. We've had parents who've been very good with us at times when our stage demands, what Galinsky's describing through this book, when our stage demands fit what our parents were able to do. And then we've had other periods with our parents when they didn't do so well because they couldn't deal with the demands that we were making, and we'll look at those kinds of differences in a few minutes. We also have the conflicting images between partners. When you think about yourself as a parent, if you do that, as you're developing that image, that's one side of what may become a cubical image. It's a cube. It's got different facets. It's got different faces. A pyramid, perhaps. Or at least a coin. It has your image of what you're going to be like as a parent. And on the other side, it has what your partner thinks you ought to be like as a parent. And those images may conflict. You may think that the father's supposed to be the authoritarian, and then you may be with somebody who thinks that his job is to spoil kids and make up for your authoritarianism. And those images have to be reconciled. Sometimes when people start into the parenting process, they're denying images that they have. They're denying the experience that they've had. It's fascinating teaching family systems, because one of the things that occasionally happens, it's not real common, but it's occasional, and it's very powerful when it happens. You have a student who starts the process of studying human development and family thinking, there are two ways this happens. One is thinking that her parents are absolutely perfect, and she couldn't have had better parents. And by the time she gets to the end of junior year or the beginning of senior year, the image is changing. the image is changing. We're looking at what they did, what they could have done, what they didn't do, and having a different understanding of the transactions that go into parenting. Sometimes it goes the other way. People think their parents have been really lousy, and by the time they finish looking at their parents through a more informed lens, they discover, you know, my parents did a pretty good job given the situation that they were in. And respect for parents' competence often grows as you look at them and understand what it takes to be a parent. Many people don't have that opportunity to change their perspective. So they come in with the delusion or the illusion about their parents, their understanding of it that they've constructed, and may not understand what was really going on for their parents. So they're missing an image. The image is false of what they actually experienced. Sometimes in the couple relationship, one of the issues that happens is that you know what other pregnant people are like, but you deny that. You deny the reality of that. Particularly naive men are likely to do this. They didn't marry you pregnant. They married you pre-pregnant. And they have somehow deluded themselves that when you get pregnant, you're not going to be like all those other pregnant women. You're not going to gain 35 pounds. You're not going to get however it is that your image of pregnant women is. You're going to be the perfect, stay exactly as you are, but maybe bulge a little in the tummy and just glow. So you're going to get actually more attractive. And that's a denial of the reality that is likely to happen if you've been around pregnant women again through the 8th and 9th month. The reality is much more beautiful than that, but it's different. It's different. It's much more beautiful, but it's different. You have to accept the pregnancy and its reality. Eventually, now we're into pregnancy. We're into pregnancy. This is real. Now we're in the heart of revising the image to fit the reality of pregnancy, Galinsky says. And the reality of pregnancy, if we've never been there, we've never had it from the inside. We've never had it with a partner. We've never had that reality, and we have to revise the images. And we face the challenge of accepting the reality, and we have to accept eventually the reality of the separateness of this baby. And that begins to happen fairly early in many pregnancies as people are experiencing morning sickness. You have to wrestle with why this is happening, you know, why this is happening to me, and then accepting the reality that it's because you're pregnant that things are changing and you are being made uncomfortable by the processes that your body is going through in order to accommodate this pregnancy. And then quickening happens, as Galinsky describes. You begin to be able to feel the baby in the second trimester. And the challenge then is you can feel this baby. The reality then is that it is real. It is in there. It is in there. By golly, it's actually in there. It operates on its own. And that raises a whole host of issues about control and loss of control, as she describes. But this baby is in there, and it is beginning to create transactions already. It's not just the indirect effect on your body that's giving you morning sickness and hormonal changes that you're aware of, but it's also now initiating transactions by moving, and you're aware of those. That begins an awareness of the transaction and the beginning of a real dyadic relationship with this infant, not yet born. The fun part of that process is that then you can begin to initiate actions within the dyadic transaction. Okay, so you begin to create a relationship very early on with this fetus. It initiates by moving. It does its somersaults. It's like an astronaut. I love the image of that. It's like an astronaut bouncing off one wall and then kicking itself off the other wall. The walls happen to be you, and sometimes when it kicks, particularly as it gets bigger, what it's kicking is your bladder, and that's not very good. As it gets bigger, it's going to stand on the nerve that supports your leg, and you're going to collapse, third trimester stuff. And this, what's happening is that you are having transactions with something that you have no control over. So you start trying to develop reciprocity with it and predict its responses. So you're creating that dyadic relationship. And this becomes a couple activity. Let's see what we can do. For example, in some cases, some people discover that they can induce hiccups. Some fetuses are responsive. Some of them are responsive to wheat products. So if you eat bread and then lie down, some babies will begin to hiccup. Some of us retain that response. I give personal. I have always had a hiccup reflex reaction to bread eaten without something to accompany it. So if you want me to hiccup, just hand me a dinner roll to eat without anything to go with it. And 9 times out of 10, I will begin to hiccup. Doesn't last very long, but there it is. Prenatally, some infants do the same thing. There's times of day for some children, fetuses, that they get active. So you can decide, okay, watch this. Watch this. I'm going to make my baby start being active. This is control. This is creating the reciprocity in the dyadic relationship and beginning to play games with the fetus. So people will discover that if they want the baby to become active, there's a very simple initiative that they can take. Lie down, try to go to sleep. Lie down and try to go to sleep. It's 10 o'clock, you need to be in bed, you need to go to sleep. Predictably, some fetuses will then wake up and start doing somersaults. They're responding to the change in position. So if you want somebody to be able to realize that you have a baby, your mother-in-law is there, she wants to know that this baby is real, just change position. If you're lying down, stand up. If you're standing up, lie down. The baby will respond, the fetus will respond to the change in position, and it will start rearranging itself. And you can see it. Now, there you are. You bare your belly, you can see this movement in the abdomen. So people begin to create the dyadic relationship that they're going to then continue for the rest of their lives. It begins very early on. And people get fascinated by it. Figuring out when the baby is going to be awake, when it's going to be asleep, when it's going to be quiet, how they can annoy it, how it will respond. Some of you have seen the movie with the young about-to-be father making whale noises against the woman's abdomen and having the baby move in response to that. Many of us are desirous of participating and making it a triadic relationship as fathers. Some men, and this becomes a problem for the couple, some men don't want anything to do with this whole process whatsoever. Some women don't want anything to do with this whole process. It's happening in their bodies, but they don't want to really participate. And those are both risk factors. If a woman wants to not participate in the dyadic relationship with her baby, she wants it out, she wants to be a mother maybe, she wants the pregnancy over, and she's not creating a dyadic relationship with the fetus, we have a risk, because she may continue that lack of interest in creating a relationship. no low reciprocity, low affect. This is a problem. If a man doesn't want to be a participant in the pregnancy, then we have the risk that he's not going to be interested in parenting in an active way after the baby is born. And that may put his relationship with the baby at risk. It also is likely to create, for the woman, some reduction of the positive affect and positive regard for her partner. If he begins to withdraw and doesn't want to get engaged in this pregnancy with her and finds it distasteful, what's going on in her body, and finds it irrational and bizarre to create a dyadic relationship with something you can't see, those are risk factors both for his relationship with the dyad, with the child, and for his dyadic relationship with the mother. And he's going to be much less supportive, potentially, if he's not engaged. It's any absence, any period of absence. The question is, if the father's not around during the pregnancy but is present for the birth, what's the impact of that? And what I've just said suggests that there's some potential for less engagement. It depends on why the father is not present, and it depends on the mother's attitude toward that, and it depends on the father's interest in overcoming that, of compensating for that. So many fathers who can't be around, I'm thinking of military deployment, travel, that for some reason they're not there, they can still be interested and involved at a distance, and they can be supportive. Email and video are absolutely wonderful. Webcams are, and chat rooms are the technological bridge between wherever we are and where we'd like to be. And if the father is able to participate at a distance in as much as he can, in as involved a way as he can, then that's a good sign. If being absent, it's absence makes the heart forget. If out of sight, out of mind, then that's a problem. Unless he comes back, okay, I'm here now, I want to be involved, I want to know everything that's happened. So it's attitude and how he's developing the image and how he's participating in the changes that are taking place during this pregnancy. And that's, it may be predictable from past. It may be something that you can help support as the mother. It's something that other people can support. I was thinking about the deployment issue. One of the things that happens when your buddies find out that your partner is pregnant is that they change your role. And I've heard soldiers particularly talk about the fact that when their wives announced that they were pregnant, the company, the unit, changed their role, began to be concerned about them as potential parents, and that became the topic of conversation. This happens at work, it happens at school for us too. If people know we're about to become parents, they change the way they deal with us. Our role in society changes. Changes again when you become a parent. It changes more dramatically then. But I've heard soldiers describe the fact that they were hindered in their role as soldiers by the fact that their buddies were reducing their risks because their wives were pregnant. So their buddies were pushing them out of the way of risk, limiting their exposure, and the change was directly attributable to he's going to be a daddy, or he just became a daddy. And that, I think it's a natural and understandable reaction that we all have, that we want to make sure that people are around to be parents. Yeah, thank you for that question. Okay, we're looking at the changes in the image of ourselves. That's a process. Okay, wow, I've got to figure out how I'm going to be a father now. And other people are going to help me figure that out. They're not going to let me forget, as in the previous example. And they're going to encourage me to talk about that role. So that's all part of changing the images to fit the reality of the pregnancy. Most of us begin to renegotiate and review our images of our own parents. Oh, I'm going to be a parent. That puts me in the same category as my father or my mother. I'm going to have the experience that they have had with me for so long. How am I going to adapt to that? How's that going to change me as a person? How do I make sense of that? We change our images of the partner. Our partner is changing, though we're forced to do that. But we're also beginning to look at our partner as a potential mother. And some of us don't do that very much before we get pregnant. We don't think about our husbands as fathers in the same way before pregnancy we do after pregnancy. It becomes much more immediate. Okay, I got to shape him up now before this baby is born because he's got to move into this role. So there can be tension, there can be some push for change within the dyadic relationship focused on molding each other into a more appropriate representation of the image of the ideal parent. We begin to look at future roles. Okay, this baby is real. People start anticipating. I've watched parents, it's fun because I've done it myself. It's fun when parents start laying out a long-term calendar and think, okay, this baby is going to be born in October. That means it'll start school in September of whatever that year is. And so we need to think about eighth grade graduation and then high school graduation. Let's see, now we have 18 years to start saving for college, and this child will be in the class of, let's see, the ones born this year in October will be in the class of 7 plus 2029. Wow! You can feel that, can't you? Thinking about the class of 2028 or 2029, that year begins to be real when you're pregnant. You never thought about the year 2028 or 2029. You would go to Professor Shelton's funeral about that time. No. Now, 2040. 2040. Plan my wake. Plan to go. There'll be a memorial service. I'll be 98. So plan that. Okay. How many of you do that kind of long-term planning? You've figured out when you're going to die. You figured out when you're going to retire. You figured out when your first child is going to graduate from college. Yeah. Most of us just totally ignore that kind of stuff. We don't think about it until we get pregnant. And when we get pregnant, there's this fascinating piece that happens in our heads. We begin to develop a scheme for the lifespan of this child. From the time it's likely to be born until the time it's likely to die, there's an implicit lifespan. And we can start attaching years to it because we know what year it will be born. And what month? And it makes a difference in some jurisdictions if you're born in August or September, which school class you'll be in. Because in many cases, you have to be six by the 1st of September. So that makes a difference. If you're born in August, it's different than September. you start figuring those things out. And the tendency to do that gets stronger and stronger once you start celebrating a real birthday. Here's the kid. And people start, and they do. You can go buy a t-shirt for the infant. Some of you have seen them. Some of you will buy them and give them to relatives as being a good aunt and uncle. Look for them in the store. The current t-shirts probably say UVM class of 2028. I haven't looked. But you can buy a t-shirt for your new infant that will identify the time of graduation. The Social Security Administration will start keeping track as soon as you get the kid a Social Security number, which used to happen when we were 15 or 16, and now it happens when you're 2. You get the Social Security number. The Social Security Administration begins to calculate when you will start drawing benefits. And born in 2007, you'll be eligible for benefits when you're 69, I think, maybe 70. So 2077, we've got to have enough money in the national treasury to pay your Social Security benefits. Time becomes more vividly and more articulately defined. That's creating future images. What is it going to be like to be this fetus's parent at Parents' Weekend when this child goes to the boarding school that every kid in the family for 3 generations has gone to? Right? We know what those open houses, those Parents' Weekends are like. Now we can start putting them on our calendar. And sometimes we begin to realize that some things are never going to be the same. And nostalgia starts to set in as we remember things that, well, you know, there was a time when we could do anything we wanted to do and stay up as late as we wanted to do and go away for the weekend as long as we had somebody to feed the cat. And now we are going to have a child and this is not going to happen. Kiss it goodbye until the empty nest comes around or you send the kids off to boarding school. So what's happening psychologically is we're changing our attitude toward the past and toward the future. And then as we get closer to delivery time, the images of birth begin to be more real. And parents are likely to be involved in childbirth preparation classes. That becomes an issue within the couple, whether that's going to happen. Typically it does now. Fathers do participate, but some fathers are not happy about this imposition on their time and the expectation that they're going to be supportive, nurturing, competent, and not throw up or faint in the delivery room. There is a good deal of anxiety for many of us about what is likely to happen at the birth. It has changed a little bit. It's a little more father-friendly. When our children were born, they had just started allowing fathers in the labor room and the delivery room. It was an option, and you had to request it, and you had to pay for the extra nurse to be present at the delivery for the father. And they had to have sufficient staffing. This was 1968 when our first child was born at McGee Women's Hospital in Pittsburgh, which has 6,000 deliveries a year. They were not comfortable with having fathers in the delivery room, so you had to pay for the extra nurse for as long as she, at that time, was there. And that nurse was strictly assigned to keep the father healthy. As we've had more experience, we've discovered that fathers really don't faint very often, and they don't throw up at delivery, particularly if they've had any kind of preparation. But there is anxiety about that, about the participation, and that gets involved in the couple relationship. what Galinsky doesn't really make very specific, but you can imagine it, is what's happening to the home microsystem while all of this adjustment is taking place for the couple. They're in their microsystem. Their relationships to work may have changed. Their relationships at work may have changed as people identify them as preggers or pregnant and anticipate. You start participating as the target for all of the jokes about new parents, which everyone at work will tell you, and you have to deal with now fitting into the culture in that role of expectant father and expectant mother. And people will tell you, this is one of the difficult things about pregnancy, people will tell you every horrible story they have ever heard. And they will tell you all of, people are wonderful. They love to tell you how bad it's going to be. And they will tell you why you shouldn't have had the child scheduled to be born at the time of year that you did. No matter when it is, there is a horrible story about that time of year. Somebody will have it. Oh, you should have had the child in February. It's much nicer at the hospital then. A friend of mine had her child in July, and the hospital was so busy and they didn't have any nurses that all the kids got sick and the mothers were neglected. And you have to figure out how you're going to just ignore all of that stuff. But it will happen because that's part of the macro system. Everybody else wants to share their experience with you. Okay, that was about images. The other theme, one of the themes that runs through this image-making stage is the changes in the roles and relationships. We've talked about a lot of those. These are the things that Galinsky focuses on. We talked about the beginning attachment, accepting the realities and of the pregnancy and its effect on the couple relationship, the separateness of the baby, preparing for changes, reviewing relationships with your own parents and evaluating your relationship with the partner. We've already covered all these. And changes in that. And then one of the things that she doesn't talk about is that relationship through the birth process. And so you think about just the relationship issues that are taking place in this 9-month period of the pregnancy. You can see the couple relationship is undergoing a lot of change because of the pregnancy. Galinsky describes several themes, and these themes are interpretable as being about the dyads and about the roles and your developmental status. There are many molar activities involved in pregnancy, getting prenatal care, getting prepared for baby, taking prenatal or taking the birth preparation classes, the molar activity even of anticipating what the demands are going to be and how you're going to fulfill them. And once you start talking about the molar activities, then you have the issue of developmental status. Are you able to engage in these molar activities in a way that is that shows that you are taking initiative in this enterprise? Or are you waiting for somebody else to tell you what to do? And in typical couples, it's not unusual for the woman to be running the show at this point. She's the one who's pregnant. She's the one who's thought about parenthood. She's the one who's forced into that. And she has major concern. And some men are pretty passive about it. So they're not going to jump into the parent role and start taking initiative for preparations. They're much more likely, not all of us, but many of us, to sit back and wait to be told what to do. The same thing that happened in weddings, you know, when we got married. We sat back, as my nephew so nicely put it, just tell me what to wear, where to stand, and when and what to say. And other than that, I don't want any part of the planning. Fortunately, he's married to a very definite articulate, clear, highly organized attorney. So she was perfectly able to tell him where to stand, what to wear, what to say, and when to shut up. So. And they're still very happily married. They're even starting to think about having children. Oh, the themes. Galinsky says, in the parents' discussions of what was going on in pregnancy, there are themes of being in control and losing control, not being able to anticipate what's going to happen. And that's about your power and your role. Is it a passive role? Who's in charge? You or the fetus? You or the medical establishment? Who's in charge? Separateness and connectedness. Connectedness to the fetus. What is happening? How separate can you be? That's an issue. And that's an issue about affect and reciprocity. How do you feel about being separate? How do you feel about being a participant? Connected to this pregnancy, connected to this fetus, connected to the role. Is that scary and negative, or is that positive and you're really looking forward to it? Giving and getting. What are you getting out of this? And what do you have to give? You have to give up alcohol. You have to get more sleep. You start anticipating giving up a role at work, perhaps. Perhaps changing your spending habits, budgeting, perhaps living on less discretionary income. This fetus is going to take a lot of support. Giving a place to the in-laws who now have new interest in you and your relationship, not because of you, but because of the fetus. Independence and dependence. Can you continue to do all the things that you wanted to do? How are you going to depend on your partner? Can you? And for some people, that's difficult. Some of us have been raised to be independent, and we don't like to be dependent on other people, but when you're 8 months pregnant, you're dependent. And you have to wrestle with that. Some of us have difficulty having people depend on us. We want our partners to be independent. When they start depending on us, that's a conflict. There's a problem for some of us in having people be dependent around us. And that's a problem. Nostalgia and impatience. I love the contrast. Some women love being pregnant. They feel wonderful. They love the whole process. It's a wonderful process. And then they balance that with being impatient about getting this over. You know, come on. Get out here, kid. I want to know what you look like. I want to have a real relationship with you. I want to start teaching you to play baseball. Now, Galinsky is going to follow these same themes as they develop through all of the stages. Because she said these are issues that are common in parenting across the stages. They have different manifestations. They just play out in different ways. So we'll come back to those. Then the baby is born. How about that? And we enter the nurturing stage. The major task, she says, is to create a relationship with this baby. Notice how we just jumped over birth. We didn't do any of the mess or the agony or the pain or the joy of that, we just jumped right over it. And there we are in the nurturing stage. We have to form an attachment to this baby and deal with the image that we had, which is not likely to match what we got. Ideally, it will look a little bit like one of us, at least. Ideally, it won't have any defects. Ideally, it will sleep at the appropriate time, nurse easily, and be warm and cuddly, and not spit up too much, and not poop while we're holding it. That's the ideal. The reality has to be accommodated. Parents have to accept the new role. and change their relationship with each other. This is the theme we've been chasing. And their own parents. They have to deal with the fact that they have just made the previous generation, the older generation, grandparents. Some of us don't like that. Some of us love it. But for grandparents, it is a clear change in role. Now you are a grandparent. And that means you just got kicked into that stereotypic role of grandparent. And you remember your own grandparents. Remember your grandparents? They're old. You know, they're old and they're infirm and frail and have nasty habits. And then when you become a parent, you can ignore that. And when you become a grandparent, you're one of them. And people start talking to you differently. You've done that to your parents, and you have to reconcile that. You have to redefine all those roles and all those relationships and incorporate this new person into both the microsystem and the mesosystem. And it changes the relationship with the extended family. It changes the microsystem mightily. The mighty change. The big issues in the nurturing stage are nurturing. They're all related to nurturing. You have to change the image, you have to take on this new role and this new relationship, but you have this huge new molar activity. And for many people, it's the first time they have ever had anything so dependent, so immature, and so important. It's not the same as when your parents gave you a duckling when you were a kid and it died because you didn't take care of it properly. It doesn't work that way. This is an incredibly important task. It is literally a life and death activity. And that's a challenge for some of us. Some of us don't like that kind of responsibility. And it may be the most intense responsibility that we will ever have. And we're doing it with another person. So this molar activity is new for most of us. And we've had bits and pieces of it, but it's never actually been ours. And parents, as Galinsky describes it, often are startled and stunned by the reality of, oh my God, this is my baby. And parents feel an overwhelming affective response to that. And sometimes it's incredibly positive, and that has many variations. This came out of me. Look what we produced. Wow, isn't that incredible? You know, here it is. I'm holding it. This is a new life. This is a very positive affect that is important for developing the attachment with the infant. For others, it's very negative. And mothers and fathers will describe how horrified they were to realize that they had a living human being that they were responsible for. And it's scary. And it's not positive. It's anxiety-producing. I had one father tell me that he had never known terror in his life. He'd done all kinds of risky things. He had never been terrified by anything he'd done until he held his son and realized that he had no idea what to do and that he was totally unprepared for this responsibility and suddenly was faced with doubt about his ability to be a father. And it took him about 3 months to get over that with a lot of support from a lot of friends and family to stop being anxious. He would literally wake up sweating in the middle of the night thinking about the possibility of failure. And he'd never really failed at anything. It was the first time he'd ever been that anxious, and he described it as terrifying. And it wasn't a happy, you know, some people say, oh, it's a terrifying responsibility, and they're really proud of that. He was scared, and it was very negative. I don't recall that he wet his pants, but it was that kind of terror. How do you nurture? Infants are wonderful. They will force you to nurture. They will demand to be fed. They will cry if you don't feed them. They will cry if you're not doing it right. They will cry if they're too hot. They will cry if they're too cold. They will cry if they're scared. They will cry if, you know, all that stuff. And there you are on their schedule, doing what they need, when they need it, in the way they want it, and hoping that they will like you and that you will be successful. And they don't care when your favorite TV show is, or what you would rather be doing on Saturday night, or that you really wish you could just have a good stiff drink, or they don't care that your husband is drunk. They don't care. They don't know any of that. And yet, whatever is going on, you get to nurture them. And you put everything else aside to nurture them. And you do that at the beginning, and then you do that for the next few months, and then you do that for many more months, and then it goes into years, and lots of things that you thought you needed to do, you discover don't have to be done. Laundry, dust bunnies, it doesn't matter. Fun, sex, having extra money, all of those things are secondary to the nurturing that you have to do. And some people love that responsibility, and they do it very well. And they love the nurturing stage. The idea of having a baby snuggled in there to watch, to sleep with, to, you know, be all, to look at you, to develop attachment with, is a very wonderful image for many of us, and a wonderful activity. For some people, it is a drag. For some people, nurturing, giving, being present, making somebody else top priority is a problem, and they don't do it well. The nurturing stage is a great challenge for many people, and they are at risk as parents, and their children are at risk developmentally. For some people, it's a huge challenge to put aside things that you have wanted to do. For some people, it's a huge challenge to share the nurturance that is being showered on this child that should be coming your way. So for some people, as I mentioned on Monday, it's very difficult to have everybody be interested in the baby and only secondarily interested in you. With later children, and Galinsky's talking primarily about firstborns, but if you look at later children, one of the things that you can watch happening in a family when the second or third child is born, people are still coming to look at the baby, and you can watch the older children watch this happen, and you can watch them figure out ways they can get rid of this little thing. Okay, maybe if I push the baby carriage down the stairs. Maybe everybody will remember that I'm here. But they're not paying much attention to me, so how am I going to do that? And I tried being cute. I tried being cute. They weren't looking at me. I tried saying something cute. They weren't listening to me. They were looking at what's-its-name. So that didn't work. I know other ways to get their attention. Here I go. Crayons on the wall. Oh. I wonder what happens if you flush two of the baby's diapers down the toilet at the same time. Will you get attention? Yes, you will. What happens? You know, and you all have been there. You've all done it. If you're an older sibling, you know, you've watched it happen. So parents sometimes are in the same position of being jealous of the attention the other parent is giving to the baby. and they sometimes do strange things to try to get your attention. So some of us have difficulty nurturing. Some of us have difficulty watching other people get the nurturing that we thought we should get. Some people have difficulty with the lack of reciprocity because they don't see the baby giving them anything. And so, what are you giving me back? Not much at this point. Unless you are a student of infants and want to watch it, then you're getting knowledge and you're getting experience. The nurturing may come very easy. It's part of what we think of for parenthood. And some of us look forward to that. We know how to do it. Some of us don't. And it's a challenge. And then, as we nurture, the baby gets more and more competent. And it begins to do more and more things on its own. Think developmental status and motor activities. And it begins to be mobile. And it begins to talk. And it begins to say no. And it begins to do things like push its baby brother down the stairs. Those things. Oh, one Gwen story. My beautiful blonde daughter was the firstborn. And just wonderful child. And we thought we had it. Really, I'm a child psychologist after all. So when her baby brother was born, the plan was that Daddy would spend much more time with Gwen. So I did. I rearranged my schedule and I inhibited my impulse to want to be with the newborn, and I spent a lot more time with Gwen, and she was still miserable. And she was unhappy, and she was creating problems, and she was having temper tantrums at 2.5. And we finally got it. Daddy was not a substitute for Mom. The plan that worked was to say, okay, Dad takes care of the newborn. Mom is what Gwen wants. So she got Mom. We adjusted. And she was okay most of the time. But there was the wonderful day when Christopher had been crying. He was on the bed. He'd finally calmed down, but it had been a long afternoon. And so Christopher was lying on the bed, and Mom and Gwen were sitting on the bed, little platform bed, and Mom said to Gwen, "Well, he stopped crying. I guess he's going to be human. I guess we can love him again." And Gwen said, "Yeah, but sometimes I'd like to knock his little head off." That's legitimate. It's legitimate if you think it and are able to say it so your parents can help you understand it, but it's not legitimate to do it. And she, for the most part, resisted the temptation to knock his little head off. I should ask him to do me a little video about whether or not I'm right about that. I don't recall. He still has his head. Yeah. When I talked to him the other day, he was still intact. Okay, so then we go on to the authority stage, which happens because kids become more competent. They're growing up. They're learning to talk. They're getting motor skills. This is a very different stage. They still need to be nurtured, but we have to deal with the fact that they can leave us. They can walk away from us. They can run away from us. They can hide from us. They can tell us no. They can flush two Pampers down the toilet at the same time. They can stick things in the electrical socket. They have wonderful motor skills. They can push their baby brother down the steps. They can turn on the stove. They can do all of that wonderful stuff that we don't want them to do. They can run out into the street. And they don't have enough sense not to. So the issue becomes authority. Parents are propelled very early, 18 months, 2 years, into a new stage by the necessity to restrict the child's behavior. Nurturing is about supporting children and encouraging them to do things and enjoying the reciprocity that you have with them. And the increasing complexity of the reciprocal activities that you can engage in. But in the nurturing stage, you have most of the control. So power resides with the parent. There's a psychological power that newborns have and infants have. But in the authority stage, what is happening is that the power is switching. The power is shifting, not because of anything you did, but because the kid is growing up. So the power in the relationship is changing. The child has more of it and is using that power in part to test the limits and to push your buttons and to explore the world and to make messes and to tell you, no, I'm going to do it myself. Developmental status. The kid wants to choose her own motor activities and do things on her own initiative when you're not telling her to. We want that to happen. We want the kid to develop, but it makes us become authorities. We have to figure out what it is she can do, what we can do, how to respond to the limits that we need to set, what kinds of consequences to have, how to discipline when the kid looks at us defiantly and says, no, and you tell them to stop doing something and the kid looks at you and does it again. And does it again. And does it again, no matter how loud you yell. So the challenges of the authority stage are figuring out that you are the adult, you are in charge, you have to restrict this beautiful little child who is exploring the world, because this little child is going to get hurt or die or get injured or break something important, and it's your responsibility to set the limits and to teach the child to respect the limits. That's your job. And it's not nurturing. It's a very different task. It's a task of setting the limits, being the one restricting the child, and figuring out how to discipline, how to deal with a kid who is clearly, intentionally, deliberately defying you. How do you feel about that? The affect may turn quite negative. The kid may be learning to be engaged in very complex motor activities. A temper tantrum is a very complex activity. Very complex activity. And you have to figure out how to deal with it. It's different from nurturing. It requires completely different skills. And some of us who are wonderful at nurturing see disciplining as nasty. We don't want to do that. We can't do that. We want to continue to nurture and indulge and see the kid be happy, and as we do that, we begin to create a monster for society to deal with if we're not willing to be an authority. Some of us don't know how to be authorities. How do you discipline a 2.5-year-old? How do you set limits and help the kid develop? How do you maintain the positive affect while you're telling a child he can't do something? And in fact, you're removing the child from a situation the child wants to be in, and you're taking the child someplace where the child doesn't want to be, and the child is kicking you in the gut all the time while you're moving the child and screaming because you're doing something the child doesn't want you to do. How do you deal with that? And keep the affect positive while the kid is making it all negative? How do you like your kid who's being incredibly annoying? That's a challenge, and it's a major challenge for people who have had parents who have not shown them how to do that. And many of us spend a lot of time learning to be nice and supportive and emotionally available, and our child will force us to be adults and to know what the limits are. That's our job, to become adults. And being an adult setting limits means that sometimes you have to have a child who doesn't like you. Okay? That comes with the territory. And that's not the image that lots of us have when we think about our child. But our responsibility is to create a microsystem that includes limits for the child, routine for the child, things that the child can't do. Anybody? No, straight back. Thank you. And that requires that we be organized in a different way. We have to change our role. The role of teaching the child what the child needs to do coming from over there. That role is very different from the nurturing role. It's just as important as the nurturing role, but it's different. And some of us aren't comfortable being organized and thoughtful and putting up with the response of children that we're putting limits on. And we're trading unconditional love for respect. The rewards are different during the authority stage. Okay. Play with those concepts. How are the nurturing stage and the authority stage different? And why would some people have more difficulty with one than the other? And put your name on that, and when you're done with that, put it on the table down here. And I'll see you on Monday.